On June 26th, 2015, two words rang out across the nation. Love wins. Marriage equality is now the law in all 50 states. Today, we're talking about the past, present, and future of LGBTQ rights. We'll be looking back at a few civil rights milestones on the path to marriage equality with people who lived through that history. George Raya played an important role from the 1970s to today. He told us about the court challenges and legislative fights to protect LGBT civil rights in the earliest days of change. Ben Adler spoke with three openly gay lawmakers about crafting California's LGBT laws. And two McGeorge Law professors reflect on the legacy of Sacramento's most important jurist, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. I'm Randall White. That's all today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is a special edition of Insight. I'm Randall White. Today we're talking about the past, present, and future of LGBTQ rights. Civil rights for those who identify as LGBTQ have evolved significantly since members of that community stood up to police raids at New York's Stonewall Inn back in 1969. Sacramento's George Raya was a central figure during several equality milestones in California, including one dating back to 1970 on the Sac State campus that changed the landscape for student clubs statewide. He was also instrumental in getting the state to decriminalize same-sex relationships. George Raya joined us to share memories from his front row seat over the past five decades. He started by telling us about his first meeting with the Society for Homosexual Freedom at Sacramento State.
When we had our first organizational meeting, which was at a professor's home, every time there was a knock on their door, we froze because we didn't know if it was the police coming or if it was another person coming to attend the meeting.
Because at that point, it was illegal.
Oh, yeah. Unapprehended felons, you know.
So 2019, the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, also marks the 50th anniversary of your coming out. Did Stonewall play a role in that?
No. It was during my freshman year, and I knew I was gay back, like, seventh grade, but never did anything about it. And then college, you experiment, and so that's when I came out. I was the fourth person in my family to come out, so it was easier for me, and I had kind of role models in the family, two lesbians and a drag queen cousin.
It seems like it was easy, especially given the time frame. When you see how easy it is for children to come out today, not for all kids, but for a growing number of young adults, do you look and just think, wow, you live in a different world?
It helped give me the stability and foundation to be an activist because I didn't have to worry about family.
Yeah, and you quickly became an activist. Yeah. It was a book that you read that sent you down that path.
A Law Review article. And the premise was nothing was going to change until gay people themselves stood up and fought for civil rights. It wasn't going to be handed to us. So that's when I knew we have to fight. And that helped me decide, yes, go forward with the lawsuit. Because at the time, my then boyfriend was horrified at the idea because he had introduced me to his family who lived in River Park. And he thought, oh, my God, if they found out you're gay, they're going to know I'm gay. And
then so, the whole domino effect. You mentioned a lawsuit, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. In 1970, you helped form the Society for Homosexual Freedom, which in today's verbiage sounds antiquated, but
it was radical for the time.
Right.
Because it had homosexual in the title.
That was deliberate.
Yes. Because up till then, most organizations were very nondescriptive. Society of Individual Rights, Managing Society, One Incorporated.
So people could attend without everyone knowing what was going on.
We lost half the membership just when we decided to have homosexual in the name because that was really being upfront. And we wanted to be upfront.
And we should mention this club was on the Sac State campus.
Yes. Marty Rogers, who was a professor, was the person that came up with the idea because he'd been called in to UC Davis because the students there had organized, but they went by the name C, the letter C7, which was the temporary building they met at. They never picked the name other than that, just the number of the office building they met, because they wanted to stay hidden. And so administration called him in to meet with them to see if he could help them. And he went back to administration. No, they're fine. They're well-adjusted. They're just gay.
And we should mention, this is a time when gay bars did not have windows to the outside. Police could come knocking at the door at any time, right, just for meeting.
Well, that whole period, you know, we were unapprehended felons to the police because it was illegal. Ministers said we're sinners, and mental health people said we were abnormal. And so, then most bars had blanked out windows and plain doors, not much signage. And I remember that one of the first bars to get windows where you could see in and out was a bar in San Francisco, 74, the Twin Peaks.
The Twin Peaks, right at the corner of
17th and, well, Castro and Market.
To this day, it's right there with the big windows. And put us in that era. You're openly gay on the Sac State campus. You're helping form this club that has homosexual in the name. Were you taunted, teased?
No. I first, when I came to campus, came under the Educational Opportunity Program. I was a Latino activist. And I was very fortunate. I had a mentor, a woman, Elena Caro. She had come back from Peace Corps from Colombia, and she decided to continue doing that kind of work. So she took me under her wing and gave me all kinds of training, you know. I never accepted the stereotypes of Mexicans. So I sure was not going to accept the stereotypes of LGBT community. When we started the club, it really helped build community, because we had interdisciplinary courses like gay studies program, and it really, really gave me a good foundation. Because when I was lobbying at the Capitol, how you project yourself is really important.
So you wanted this club on campus to be sanctioned by the school so that it could have all the same rights as the other clubs on campus. What happened then?
I was on the Student Senate, chair of the Organizational Affairs Committee, which all new organizations have to go through. So I helped get it approved by the Student Senate, but it was only like a 7-4 vote. The student body president, Steve Whitmore, was very supportive. We had a lot of supportive faculty and stuff. So we felt comfortable because this really was a bubble, academic campus community. But the college president was the acting president, Otto Butz, and he wanted to be appointed permanent, but he didn't get it. So he didn't want to approve a gay club that would hurt his chances of getting it post later on.
He didn't want to rock the boat.
So we had to go to court. And that was the time of student rights. Just the year before, the student body had gone to court because the administration had forbid Tom Hayden from coming on campus. So we went to court. John Paulswell, who just graduated from law school the year before, became our attorney for a dollar. So we won on freedom of speech, freedom of association.
And that laid the groundwork for LGBT student groups on state college campuses throughout California today?
Throughout California and also some other states.
We're speaking with George Raya on his perspective on the equality movement from his front row seat over the past 5 decades. Did many people outside of the Sac State community know what was going on? Was it a front page sort of thing?
The Sacramento Bee did send a reporter, and it just happened that he was the editor of the Hornet the year before. So I went to him, I said, Nikki is really, really uptight. Don't mention me in the article. So he didn't. So everything was okay.
Nikki but being?
My then boyfriend.
Oh. Okay. George, you were the first person to have a full-time job in the California State Legislature lobbying for gay rights.
Right. Back in 69, Willie Brown, San Francisco, introduced what he called the anti-lynching bill. We were illegal, like I said. So he introduced a bill to decriminalize consenting adult sex. But it didn't go anywhere because at the time, Ronald Reagan was the governor, and he said, if you pass it, I will veto it. So 74, Jerry Brown comes in, and we met with him and had to twist his arm. I'll just put it that way. And he said, okay, I'll let it be known. I will sign it, but I'm not going to lobby it. And it was really fortunate that year we had 22 freshmen members of the assembly. I had graduated from Sac State, political science, and back then as now, Sac State is a feeder to the state capitol. So I had lots of friends that worked there. And one friend one day said, hey, if you want a job, come see me, a summer job. So he worked for Ways and Means, and he got me a job. So I had this whole network, and I knew how it all functioned. So it was like, okay, I'm from Sacramento. I know the capital. I have friends and family there. I can do it on the cheap because there was no money. After 6 years of not going anywhere, no one was willing to write a check. It was only after we started getting out of committee, out of the assembly, that people begin to have faith because it was rough.
It narrowly passed. It was a tied vote at first, right?
Well, it passed the assembly by a vote of 41. We had 44, but Willie said, look, if we don't need your vote, sit out because people were worried about re-election. But when it went to the Senate, George Moscone was the majority leader, and he was the partner with Willie in getting the bill passed. At the first vote, it was a tie vote, 20-20. So some newspapers went to print saying the bill was defeated because it didn't pass.
They did that in Long Beach?
The Long Beach Telegraph, you know, kind of like a Dewey beats Truman. But Moscone did was hold the Senate in chambers until Willie Brown, who was out of state, he was in Colorado, could fly back and break the tie. And anyone really could have changed their vote to abstain, but everybody kept their vote where it was. And so Willie came back, Lieutenant Governor votes aye. And so all hell broke loose in the gallery because we were all in the gallery. But it made the Stars and Stripes. A friend of mine sent me a clipping from the Jerusalem Post. It was news. We were the first state to actually change the law with the spot bill, rather than doing a total reform of the criminal code.
Other states had decriminalized it, but not in this manner.
Right. Illinois had done a total reform of their penal code. But California had been trying to do that for years, and we didn't want to wait for that. We wanted a straight up and down vote.
How significant was that for the gay community? How did it change everyday life?
Up until then, we were illegal. And Willie said you couldn't have any rights until you become legal. And besides that bill, we were pushing a non-discrimination in employment. And so I had to travel around the state to convince people in the districts to lobby their local legislator because everybody was saying, oh, San Francisco was trying to push their morality on the state because both of our sponsors were from San Francisco. You know, I really wanted Larry Kapelow from San Diego to carry the bill. So we had political action groups all over the state. I mean, I traveled by bus, plane, car, Santa Barbara, San Diego, L.A., Monterey, Ventura. It was insane. But we needed the support statewide.
And you got it.
We got it.
You mentioned George Moscone, former mayor of San Francisco, who was shot and killed by Dan White, along with Harvey Milk. Did you personally know Harvey Milk?
Yes. We were all active. He ran for office 4 times. I didn't support him the first 3 times. I supported him the last one in 77. When Harvey ran, you had Rick Stoats, who was a moderate LGBT, and Harvey, who was radical. So you really had landlords versus tenants. Uh-huh. It was more economic interests, class struggle kind of thing.
George, I want to take a quick break and then we'll come back.
Okay.
That's our conversation with LGBTQ civil rights pioneer George Raya. We have more on that discussion coming up after the break. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to a special edition of Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White. We've been hearing from LGBTQ civil rights pioneer George Raya. He joined the effort to change the laws and culture of California in the early 1970s. We're going to pick up the rest of that conversation at the point where I asked him about his work with the Carter administration. In 1977, the National Gay Task Force became the first group of openly gay lobbyists invited to the White House to tackle policy issues that affected the LGBTQ community. George was invited to be part of that group.
The way that came about was Mitch Costanza, who was Carter's administrator for community engagement, was dating the co-chair of the National Gay Task Force, Gina Leary. And so Jeannie got Midge to hold the meeting. So they rounded up people from around the country. I was the only one from San Francisco. They picked people from regions, Seattle, Los Angeles, Texas. And we came together and each of us took a federal department. Mine was health and welfare. At that time, hepatitis was the big killer for LGBT community. And so I recommended that they do more research. Well, I got in trouble because I mentioned sex. And everybody else was just saying, oh, thank you for meeting with us. Such a great honor. Oh, God. Jeannie almost killed me right there at the
table.
Always
pushing the envelope, huh?
Yeah. But it was good because eventually they did fund a study, 78, 79, 80, which helped track AIDS and how it was spread. Although blood testing, they kept.
Wow. You're from Sacramento, but you mentioned San Francisco. You moved there for a while. Then you came home.
Born and raised here. Raised in Wheatland, which is a farm town north of here. Came back, graduated from Sac High. And that's where I became an activist because one day I saw on the school bulletin board, if you're interested in helping develop a conference to encourage Mexican Americans to go to college, meet here. And that's where I met Elena and helped put together this conference for students to come to campus. So I graduated 72, got admitted to Berkeley, was there for 2 years, and then moved to San Francisco. Because normally when people graduated here from Sac State, they automatically moved to the Bay Area just to be more free. And I remember one of my friends who graduated ahead of me came back one day around 1970 and was starting to talk about, wow, this great new community, Upper Market, and they got this bar, the Midnight Sun. And so that was the beginning of the Castro.
Of the Castro, yeah. And then what was it that brought you back to Sacramento?
Well, I stayed there from 74 to 90. And then one day I got a call from my sister saying, our father was sick, had cancer, come home, she needed help. So I came back, and that really saved my life because at the time, I was a volunteer. I worked with a thing called the Fairy Godfather's Fund. We were kind of like candy stripers. We would welcome each new patient, give them a robe, a teddy bear, toiletries, slippers.
These are AIDS patients.
And AIDS patients. And make their life as comfortable as possible because the nursing staff were just so busy they couldn't really give that all-important human touch.
And at this point, it really is hospice.
Oh, my God. Yeah. For client confidentiality, they just put the first name of the person in the room on the board. So when you went in and said, hello, Bob, sometimes you met someone who was the boyfriend of someone or someone you knew, and you still had to keep that smile. It was like being in a war. So many of my friends died. I stopped putting people in my address book in ink. I put them in pencil because my address book had so many crossed out names. It was every week, every day. And I just so lucky I survived.
So when you say moving to Sacramento saved your life, is that because you were removed from San Francisco's scene?
I was unfortunately beginning because of the depression.
The depression of dealing with friends dying on a regular basis.
And so I'm doing risky behavior. So coming back really kind of like got me out of that, came back and restarted my life here. Because I had thought about moving back to San Francisco, but then one day I just said, wait a minute, it's very expensive. I got a good network here. And it's an easier lifestyle. Because in San Francisco, being in politics, it's a blood sport. And I just was not that radical for a lot of the community.
Sacramento very much feels like home now?
Oh, it's always been home. Yeah. I live in Midtown. I love the trees. You know, you can walk around. Yeah.
So you've seen Lavender Heights change quite a bit over the years.
Yeah.
For better or for worse?
For better. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. My first job out of high school was at a International House of Pancakes, which was across the street from where Faces is.
This is like 20th and K.
Yeah, because when I came out, all the bars were in West Sacramento. We had a sheriff, John Misterly, Big John, who didn't want any gay bars in Sacramento. So he forced them all to West Sac. That was a real problem. You had to go West Sac if you want to go out and meet people. So when he got defeated in 1970, I remember we had a party and we were actually dancing on one of his campaign signs. Things changed. One of the first bars opened like in 76, Bojangles. And then slowly the bars in 20th and K started happening, and bookstores. The Lioness Bookstore, Open Book. So community started building there.
We're speaking with LGBTQ pioneer George Raya about his career working on civil rights issues in California.
Do you feel that there is a level of gentrification now that some of the younger LGBTQ community members can't afford Lavender Heights?
Well, not just here, but everywhere around the country. The cast was very gentrified. But some of that's good because I don't think we ever should be ghettoized. And we need to mix in the general community because we found a long time ago, people change their attitude toward the LGBT community when they get to know someone who's LGBT. So it's important that we interact with the general community. There are problems because right behind Faces, there's going to be a six-story, 142-unit apartment building. And so Terry is worried about, oh my God, they're going to be getting down on me for the noise and stuff.
Well, George, what would you like the LGBT youth or young adults of today to know about the struggles you and others went through to get us to this point?
It was difficult. I was once in a police raid, and it's horrifying because you don't know if they're going to arrest you. So we lived with a lot of terror. When I first came out, it was more like a secret fraternity. You basically socialized in people's homes. I had some older friend that graduated a couple years before me. He and his best friend took a trip cross country. Both were gay. They never told the other one that whole trip. It was something you didn't even tell your best friend because it was so bad. Employment discrimination. 40% of the LGBT youth right now are homeless because a lot of times because they're coming out early, as young as 11, their families can't handle it, so they kick them out. So it's still happening now. I mean, we have marriage equality, but we can't rest on the laurels. Mm-hmm. And we still don't have an employment rights bill federal. We have it on the state level.
If you could, George, is there mm-hmm. anything you would tell the 1969 version of you as you're coming out?
Things get better. When I look at where we are now, because I went to a fundraiser for the California Equality, and I looked around, and that's a $7 million organization now. When I started in 74, literally, I lived partly on blood plasma donations because there is no money. I looked at a budget. I was getting, like, when we had money, $400 a month, $425 for expenses. Fortunately, I had people here that I could live with. But things do get better.
You've had so many firsts when it comes to this, to LGBTQ rights. Is there anything that you didn't do that you wished you had?
Basically got the people of color more active within leadership roles because we're still working on that. And I'm really happy that the LGBT Center, Sacramento LGBT Center, recently started a bilingual outreach program and hiring staff that are bilingual. Because there are a lot of gay people from Latin American countries in Sacramento who are refugees.
So if you could, you would have encouraged LGBTQ people of color to get more involved politically.
Well, and also the organizations themselves mm-hmm. do more outreach, and which some are doing. Yeah.
Although you're retired, I get the sense that you're not done yet.
No. Actually, I'm thinking of writing my memoirs. People have been pushing me to do that. I mean, I have so many stories.
I bet. George Raya, on his perspective on the equality movement from his front row seat over the past 5 decades, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's George Raya, one of many Californians who dedicated his life to advancing the cause of LGBTQ civil rights. After the break, we'll hear Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler speaking with three openly gay lawmakers about their time in the California legislature. We have more on our website, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.
You are listening to a special edition of Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Randall White. The path to marriage equality started with small steps here in Sacramento. There were individuals advocating for change, like George Raya, and there were also the lawmakers who cast their votes to enact it. In 2015, Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler spoke with three former and current California lawmakers about the LGBTQ rights bills that did and did not pass. Former Senator Mark Leno from San Francisco and current Assemblymember Susan Talamantes-Eggman from Stockton reflected on the history and accomplishments of the LGBT caucus in California. And later, former Senator Roy Ashburn talks about coming out during his final term in office. First, here's Mark Leno sharing his personal story.
I came out at age 18. It was 1969, right at the time of the Stonewall riots. So it just happens that my adult life has been in coincidence with what's now known as the modern LGBT civil rights movement. When I came out, it was to announce to the world that I was a mentally ill outlaw because, of course, the American Psychiatric Association had not yet dropped from its list of mental illnesses. That was around 1973, homosexuality. And even here in California, it was still a felony for adults of the same gender to have consensual relations until around 1976. And so off I went. And I moved to San Francisco in 1977, which is the very year that Harvey Milk was elected to the County Board of Supervisors. We came very close to meeting, but sort of passing the night, never did. I started my small business in San Francisco the year he was assassinated and engaged in community affairs and volunteered my time as my business grew and I could get myself out of the office, but did not get into elected office until an appointment by then Mayor Willie Brown. I had met him on his 1995 campaign trail. I had some name recognition at the time for my involvement with the LGBT and HIV/AIDS community, small business community and such. And so that was the beginning of my efforts in public policy.
Your partner passed away from complications of HIV/AIDS.
I was very lucky to meet a beautiful young man, and well, we were all young men, 1980, named Doug Jackson, and we had 10 years together. He died in 1990.
Assemblymember Eggman, if I could, I'd like to start with a piece of tape from a couple of years ago, the previous Supreme Court ruling that struck down California's Proposition 8. And on that day, you told a story of a family member who was nearing death, and they had a five-year-old. And let's start by listening to that tape.
My partner's family is very Republican, very conservative, and very Pentecostal. And when we talked about who would raise this child, they looked to nobody but us as the people who were the most stable, who were the most able to provide a loving home, and that we would do that. And we, of course, will.
And you did.
And we did. We now have a seven-year-old.
Tell us your story.
I, like Mr. Leno, came out at a young age. I entered my first relationship probably when I was 17. And when I was 18, I joined the military. So I spent 4 years, in an environment where it wasn't okay to be gay, but certainly there was a strong acknowledgement that there were a lot of gays and lesbians in the military. I spent 4 years in the military, and that's where I met my partner for a long time, then domestic partner, and now wife. We were both active duty Army. We got out, lived our lives, engaged in life, and hopefully helped change part of the conversation that we have always been out. At that time, we lived in Turlock to be out at work, out with our family. That was in the 80s and 90s. I spent a lot of time, I'm a licensed clinical social worker and eventually obtained my PhD in social work and social research and spent 10 years as a faculty member at Sacramento State. Before that, I also was a hospice social worker for a long time. So I worked in and around both personally, academically, research-wise, and teaching with end-of-life issues. So certainly cared for a lot of people during the 80s and 90s during the AIDS crisis. So I consider myself an intentional public servant and an accidental politician. I ran for Stockton City Council in 2006, and at that time was the first person to run and be elected as an out person in the Central Valley. Mr. Leno comes from a strong tradition in San Francisco of people being out, but in the Valley it's a little bit different. but we're both here at the same place now.
We're talking with Democratic State Senator Mark Leno of San Francisco and Democratic Assembly Member Susan Eggman of Stockton. So, Senator Leno, take us back to your early years in the legislature. Talk about some of the early days and the challenges and accomplishments.
We should note it was Sheila Kuehl, who's now a county supervisor in Los Angeles, who was the very first and only member of our community to serve in the legislature. She was elected in 1994. Old joke she likes to tell is that when she went out to dinner and make a reservation, it was a Kuehl party of one. But she was joined by Assemblywoman Migdon in 1995-96, who succeeded Willie Brown, who became mayor of San Francisco at that time. And then additionally, in 2000, Chris Kehoe and Jackie Goldberg were elected. And so there were four women serving openly as lesbians in the legislature before John Laird and I joined them. Since I was succeeding Carol Migdon, she was elected to the Board of Equalization at that time, there were the five of us who then formed the first LGBT legislative caucus in the nation in 2002, the three women and John Laird and I. And it made a big difference because up until then there had been a few pieces of legislation initially carried by Sheila Kuehl. There were, of course, some allies who carried legislation. Prior to that, it was Assemblyman Art Agnos who, in 1979, introduced a bill that would include sexual orientation in our Fair Employment and Housing Act to make it illegal to discriminate based on sexual orientation in housing and employment and public accommodation. Took the state 20 years until 1999 for that to be signed into law by Gray Davis. But once we as a caucus began to focus on legislation, we made astounding gains. In fact, California was really at the back of the pack of states in legal protections for the LGBT community. But within a decade, we soared to the top and we passed over 100 pieces of legislation in that decade. We are now the best state in terms of legal protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights of any state in the country.
Let me ask you about the push legislatively to get a bill signed into law legalizing same-sex marriage. Twice it reached the desk of Governor Schwarzenegger. Both times he issued vetoes.
I remember that when we first put our bill on his desk in 2005, and he vetoed it. The New York Times editorialized saying that he was hiding behind the fig leaf of Prop 22. He, of course, could have signed it should he have actually understood what equality was about.
Assemblymember Eggman, fast forwarding to today, talk about what that leaves the LGBT caucus, or more importantly, the California legislature to do next.
I mean, I think it is our responsibility, but I think it goes deeper than that. Certainly, there is still legislation that needs to be passed for different sorts of equal rights, especially as it relates to transgender folks. And we still have, you know, terrible issues of disparity and poverty and in jobs and homelessness. But I think changing laws and acknowledging that people have rights doesn't always quickly translate into the general public acknowledging that. I mean, it's, you know, civil rights have passed some 50 years ago, and we still see, we're just taking the Confederate flag down. We can pass laws, but it still takes a while for that to filter down, for people to understand and come to a different acceptance of you might not agree with every law or every right, but it doesn't really give you the right to spew hate speech, if you will, and the idea that words matter. This year, I think it was the most when we did the LGBT Pride resolution, 12 Republicans signed on. That's historic. Previously, they would have got up and walked out. So I, you know, personally hand wrote a thank you card to every one of them to say, thank you for your courage and bravery. I know it's not easy. So we still have a lot of work to be done, some of it legislatively, but some of it just being out in the community. And, you know, as Mr. Leno said before, he's been out since he was 19. A lot of us have been out for a while and really just trying to make being ourselves so that people can know that it's nothing to be afraid of. And so far, the world has not collapsed.
Just in your time, Assemblymember Eggman, the last few years, I think you're 3 years into your time here, name a big or a small way that you have seen the legislature evolved.
When I came into the legislature, we had our first gay speaker, and we now have our first lesbian speaker. So, you know, a body is willing to say this is our leader. And again, I think the movement of folks in the Republican Party seeing, oh, this probably is not the best thing in the world, again, to stand up and espouse a lot of hatred when the issue comes up, I think is significant. And just even in the building, I mean, we now have some, you know, transgender staff people, and there's been, you know, a little pushback here and there, and, you know, there's have to be some intervention. But things just continue to evolve and move forward, which I think is the most positive.
That was former Senator Mark Leno of San Francisco and current Assemblymember Susan Talamantes-Eggman of Stockton. The two Democrats spoke with Ben Adler about their work in the LGBT caucus at the California legislature. Now we'll hear from a former Republican lawmaker, Roy Ashburn, represented Bakersfield in the Assembly and Senate for 14 years. He came out as gay just months before terming out of office. Roy Ashburn now lives in Los Angeles, where he votes no party preference. Here's his story.
Well, I've always been gay, but because at an early age I concluded that I could not be in public life, in politics, and be openly gay, I hid that fact. And was married, have children, and lived a life as a straight man from a conservative part of California. And then 5 years ago, I was arrested for drunk driving in Sacramento after having left a gay club. Obviously, a state senator being arrested for drunk driving is pretty big news. What I didn't realize at the time was that, you know, people had seen me at the gay club in Sacramento, and so the gay rumors were running very high. And so a little more than 5 years ago, I came out publicly and announced that I was gay. I continued in the California legislature till the end of my term. And after coming out, I did a reversal on gay rights issues and have voted to support gay rights, including extending marriage rights.
As you look back now, and I know at the time you said that you were representing your district, would you have voted differently?
Yes, I definitely would have voted differently. Although the portion of California that I represented both in the state assembly and the state senate is among the most conservative areas in the United States. If I were to do it over, I would vote to grant gay rights because it's incongruous with my belief in individual liberty, personal responsibility, the maximum freedom afforded under the Constitution, that all individuals should be granted full rights.
Talk about how your former party, the Republican Party, has evolved, or whether it has evolved, on gay rights, both from your time in the legislature to the present?
Well, I think there's been a big evolution in the Republican Party. There's been a big change in public attitude about acceptance of gay individuals, but also about the issue of marriage. The Republican Party is reflective of society in general, maybe moving at a slower pace, but inevitably toward a greater acceptance that people are born the way they're born, that we are all equal under the law, and that equal rights ought to be afforded to all people.
Do you believe there will ever be an openly gay Republican elected to the California legislature?
Yes, I do.
When? How soon?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, because it will depend entirely on the individual candidate, and it will depend on the district of California where that candidate actually seeks election. But in this last election, there was an openly gay candidate, Republican, for Congress, and in a race in San Diego that was virtually a photo finish.
You're referring to Carl DeMaio, right?
Yes. So I think it will be a relatively short period of time before an openly gay Republican is elected.
What is holding it back at this point?
Fear. Fear is the great character defect that affects so many people. And politics, in many ways, is a an activity that is, you know, both proactive and reactive. I'm not saying that that's a good state of affairs, but as your prior question just indicated, it's probably not very far down the road before an openly gay person is elected who happens to be a Republican.
Talk about the life that you're living now, that you are 5 years removed from the legislature.
Well, life is definitely better. Although I would be telling an untruth if I said that I did not miss politics and service in the legislature. I was born into a desire to serve in public office, and I am very privileged to have held public office for over 26 years, and so I miss it. But on a personal level, life is much better. And so it's been a big transformation for me, a big change. There's a calm and a peacefulness and a serenity that comes in being truthful with yourself.
That was Cap Radio's Ben Adler speaking with three LGBTQ lawmakers, former Senator Roy Ashburn of Bakersfield, and before that, former Senator Mark Leno of San Francisco and Assemblymember Susan Talamantes-Eggman of Stockton. Those conversations were recorded back in 2015, just a few weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court granted marriage equality to all LGBTQ Americans. Since the first time we aired that interview, Tony Atkins of San Diego became the first member of the LGBT caucus to lead both chambers as the Assembly Speaker and the Senate President Pro Tem. And former Senator Ricardo Lara of Los Angeles became the first openly gay lawmaker to hold statewide office as insurance commissioner. Coming up, two McGeorge law professors talk about Justice Anthony Kennedy. You're listening to a special edition of Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. We're back with a special edition of Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. We'll finish this hour with a look back on the legacy of Sacramento's most important jurist, Justice Anthony Kennedy. He served as an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court for more than 30 years, from February 1988 to July 2018. He wrote several majority opinions that redefined civil rights for all LGBTQ Americans. In 2015, Justice Kennedy authored the majority ruling in Obergefell against Hodges, which granted marriage equality to same-sex couples in all 50 states. Just a few days after that decision was announced, Leslie McClurg spoke with law professors Larry Levine and John Sims. They both got to know Justice Kennedy when he was on the faculty at the McGeorge School of Law.
I have seen Justice Kennedy work, especially in our summer program at Salzburg, where he's taught for many years. So he taught constitutional law at McGeorge for 23 years before he went on the Supreme Court. Then once he moved to D.C., it wasn't feasible for him to teach in Sacramento. So then he really started teaching in Salzburg. So I've been there a couple times when he's been teaching there, and I've seen him at work. He's an incredibly conscientious person. So there are some people that, you know, like to talk a good game. They have all kinds of opinions, and they're just not willing to really bear down and do the work that's necessary. That's not his style at all. He is just an incredibly conscientious, thoughtful person. And he's willing to follow the logic of the prior cases where it leads him. One of the reasons that I think Larry and I would agree that the result reached in Obergefell was not surprising was Justice Kennedy's prior decisions, going back to the most important decision in 1996 in Romer against Evans, when it's the first time that the Supreme Court really engaged a law that discriminated against gays and lesbians and invalidated it. That was really the bedrock for everything that came later.
Is he the same person on and off the bench, Professor Levine?
I think that would be a fair assessment in that he is cautious and I think generally conservative by nature and in person, somewhat reserved. I also would add to John's point that I think he's also been very consistent, much more consistent than a lot of his colleagues in his points of view, even when I've disagreed with him, which there are many occasions where I have disagreed with the results in some of the cases. I think he is animated by an equality principle. And he, on First Amendment cases, I think he may be the closest thing to a First Amendment purist on the court. So he has a certain, I think he's got a real consistency as a jurist. And I agree with John that he's very thoughtful and deliberate about pretty much everything he does.
Given that description, thoughtful and deliberate and conscientious, it surprises me then, many critics have said that his opinions are sort of broad and sweeping and don't offer really precise enough language for legal doctrine. Is that then a fair criticism, Professor Sims?
Oh, no, those people don't know what they're talking about, really. No, I say exactly the opposite, which is that many justices indulge themselves or and say whatever they feel like, or they hide behind legal technicalities and
quote unquote, using big words.
Yeah, and they kind of wash their hands of the results that are flowing from their decisions by pretending that they don't involve real people. And I think what is true about all of Justice Kennedy's decisions for the court in these four important gay rights cases is that he actually talks about real life and about real people. My view would be that starting with Romer and going all the way through the other cases, he has really penetrated to the reality of life, which is that relationships are important to us, that we're all looking for love. We sometimes find it, we sometimes don't. And that to deny that aspect of life to any group within the population is fundamentally unfair. And he gets to that, and the other opinions don't get to that.
But once you have five votes, that is the constitutional law. And somehow that was a recent revelation to me. I should be embarrassed that that was a revelation. But I realize, you know, that is the new constitutional law, I would think. And it's something you teach, John, but due process is different now than it would have been a decade ago because of Justice Kennedy.
It sounds almost more human.
While he's more forthright in describing what is going on, that the basic approach that he takes is totally consistent with our past constitutional law. That is, you know, at one point, racial discrimination, even slavery, was perfectly okay. That was how it was done. That was normal. At another point, the subordination of women was just taken for granted. Of course, women can't think for themselves, or it's a big waste to send them to higher education or to, you know, give them any decent jobs. And that came to be seen to be wrong, that it denied the humanity of a group within the population. And his willingness to not hide behind the convenient pre-existing categories to be, I find it refreshing. Mm-hmm. But I know that those who disagree with the outcome and who reject the fundamental idea of equality that he embraces, they find this really threatening and abhorrent.
How far along the path, then, are we towards full equality?
Brown was decided in the 1950s, and we could ask ourselves how we're doing on racial equality. And the answer is not a happy one in many ways. And so I assume that we're going to have many skirmishes ahead. There's going to be huge battles over so-called religious liberty and the right of people to discriminate. So in many ways, the battle's just beginning on that front, but there's a lot ahead that will keep civil rights lawyers employed.
Professor Sims, just final question. How does this all fit into Justice Kennedy's legacy?
I think undoubtedly, starting with Romer through the marriage equality decision, mark him as the person, I think, who's done more than any other single person to promote equality for the LGBT community than anyone else in history. He has written every one of those, and what started out as being astounding and revolutionary is now taken as obvious. And so even the marriage equality decision from the Supreme Court, while there are those that don't like it, it was seen to be inevitable. And the reaction, I think, has been very muted. And in a way, it probably makes the path smoother. And as Larry says, I mean, there are a lot of other equality issues to be addressed. But the fact that this important social institution is open to everybody and that all families are going to be recognized is a huge step forward. And I think that then facilitates the political organizing and the legislative work and the judicial challenges that are necessary to bring about other aspects of equality. But, you know, that first step of recognizing that the law treats everybody equally shouldn't be underestimated.
Well, thank you both for taking this walk with me through history. I appreciate your time.
It was fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of Insight on the past, present, and future of LGBTQ rights. I'm Randall White. This program was produced by Cody Drabble. Special thanks to Ben Adler, Leslie McClurg, Beth Ruyak, Rick Cushman, Steve Milne, Kate Gonzalez, Chris Remington, James Morrison, Bert Johnson, and Jen Picard. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Senior producer is Helen Barrington. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. As always, thank you for joining us.